I would call the tomatoes were more of a, I haven't read it myself, but I was told that there was more desires and fruit-like shlokas in the Veda.
There are. If you count them, probably that's the case. But the Vedas do exist in different divisions, and these verses up.
But then in the Gita, it contradicts, like in the Gita, it says you should give up your
fruits. Yeah, that's right. How do you determine the truth? Simply by counting the number of verses?
Huh?
Yeah, that's what the Veda says. You should give up the fruits of your action and surrender to Krishna.
That's, yeah,
yeah, right.
But then you just said that the Veda shouldn't be interpreted. Otherwise...
Well, it's, you came in the middle of a long discussion. Clearly, if there's... just a second, I was looking for something else. No, I can't find the... the text I had up here. Okay, here it is. Here's the verses. Here it is. Just a second. Yeah, anyway, I can't find what I was looking for. But anyway, he says that they agreed with Chaitanya Mahaprabhu that the Vedanta Sutra, if you see it this way, it's self-evident this is what's meant. And as I mentioned in the beginning, it's seemed to me that it was sound, that it was free from contradiction, that it was complete, it accounted for all the sutras, and it did so in the most elegant manner, and it had this characteristic of self-evidence. I would say that the other sense of self-evident is that if one has understood these things properly through the process of spiritual discipline, also there will be the self-evidence of seeing, as Prabhupada says, Krishna directly in the pages of Bhagavatam. That's another sort of self-evident. It cannot be denied. Anyway, we've already had quite a discussion about how the Vedas exist in different divisions and seem to be have different disparate statements. So therefore, they have to be reconciled, and there has to be a reconciliative principle that brings to a single harmonious conclusion all the truths of the Vedas. That's not necessarily an interpretation, that's just an understanding. Interpretation means you bring your own thing to it. But what Prabhupada is trying to show how that from within the process itself, that one is guided to come to this conclusion without concoction. Anyway, that's the claim. You have to try it and see. Yeah.
Can you speak a little bit about how one who will be a follower of this prohibition of interpretation of scripture,
mm-hmm.
how he handles apparent contradictions in the scripture and the way we experience the world? I have examples in mind. For example, the time frame in which, for example, Brahma existed.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not consistent with...
with what we think we know.
What we think, I know. I have to put that
together. Yeah, right.
It's a fair, fair idea of at least the last, I don't know, 100,000 years of history.
Sure. Well, to me, there's two things you can do. Either you can take Well, you can take the modern dating as kind of conclusive or something like it, and just say that somehow or other this is, you know, some fantastic numbers dreamt up by people in another time. Or you could look at another thing and say that there's an alternative history of the universe that we don't know about. And that's what Prabhupada is teaching, actually. That basically, when Kali Yuga began, we all became brain damaged. And I kind of got cut off from the past, and there was before us a kind of much more advanced human civilization. And that we have gone down rather than gone up.
So basically you have to accept that.
Yeah, now if you want to, yeah, I think so. I mean, that Prabhupada is very clear about that, that he wants us to accept that. And I do it myself, accept it. Although, in a way, it's not so important to me.
Yeah, I'm actually a biologist, as I
told you. Yeah, sure.
And it's not important to me either, but in some way, people start asking questions like that.
Sure, sure.
And I don't know, it doesn't really bother me that it's not really consistent, but in some way, I guess you're forced to make it consistent.
Well, you know, it seems to me like if this is the judgment of Shastra, and you can, and Shastra is the ultimate authority. And if you start questioning this, then you can start questioning that, and pretty soon you become the authority. That's the problem. It is a sort of, if you can, you can doubt one thing, you can doubt the whole thing. And then you've made yourself into the authority. I mean, you know, Christianity has been dealing with this, and all these people, they want to kind of rescue something. Now they don't believe in anything that's in the Bible or the scriptures, but they want to rescue something out of it. It doesn't seem to work very well.
So you can put the onus of the truth not on the Shastras being a real source of truth, but
the onus can be on the performative aspects than the idea of truth content. Would you like to say that?
I mean, maybe the burden of carrying the truth from when it was first written is on human beings, failing human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe I can use that as a crutch and say that, maybe it was perfect when it was written, but there's a whole lot of people between when it was written and...
Yeah, in other words, the way it's been passed down. Well, again, you know, the claim Prabhupada makes that parampara is something that's solid and people have this experience. And Prabhupada has really made these claims, I have to tell you. For example, it describes in the creation of the world there are three Purusha avatars, three forms of Vishnu. And that, and it's a fantastic creation story that... although, by the way, as far as biology goes, we are all, as far as I can understand, the common genetic pool of all living beings is supported by the Vedas. The Vedas, yeah. Because we all come from Brahma. All the living beings in the world are actually genetic descendants of Lord Brahma. Yeah, so you don't need a theory of evolution for at least to count for that, you know. On the Christian grounds, you know, all these animals, maybe they evolved or something, and human beings are a special creation. You can't account for the similarity. But anyway, that's another point.
Yeah, but then the point is really good because Kumar is not here, it's gone. It's like you have some science media experience and all. Sometimes it's just attempted editing out. And this is one of the reasons, you know.
Editing out
parts of the Bhagavad Gita, you know,
you mean you can't reconcile it with what?
You cannot reconcile it, or they would actually argue about the actual truth of it.
You know, I sometimes cannot tell you. If I accept the authority of the Vedas, And I know what our current experience of the world is, and it doesn't. My tendency is to think that our current experience of the world is susceptible to a great deal of change, and that we might just really, really be surprised. It's not like the principles of mathematics are confuted. It's just our empirical knowledge of things. And as far as historical knowledge goes, well, I've already seen too many things, you know, too many well-established, totally found, you know, like the Aryan invasion. When I first became a devotee, I realized the same thing that you realized, that there was like a big difference between this history and the history I had. And I had one more semester of classwork to take, so I decided I would take an archaeology of India course. And I guess part of me half hoping to be convinced to junk Krishna consciousness, you know, because that was going to make certain demands on me that I wasn't quite sure I wanted to live up to anyway. So I was kind of, so I took this archaeology of India course, and it was really interesting. And we came to this idea that the Aryans migrated down, invaded actually, that time it was invaded from the north, that there were these Dravidian people there who were probably the people who were in Harappa and Mohenjo-Daro, and then, you know, worshipped a proto-Shiva, the horn god of the seals, and then this. And so I did a paper on this subject of Harappa and Mohenjo-Daro, and I looked to see what was the actual evidence for an Aryan invasion. And it was, you know, two pieces of potsherd. I mean, it was like almost nothing was there that somebody had constructed a story about. I was shocked, because it's taught with great confidence. It was just a standard truth. Nobody questioned that there was this Aryan invasion. And when you actually looked at the evidence for it, it was total speculation. So, that was a shock to me. And the professor agreed with me, by the way. But that doesn't mean he gave up the theory, because just everybody accepted it. Then I became a devotee, and then about 15 years later, I was at the American Academy of Religion, and some lady was getting up there presenting all the arguments about this Harappan Mohenjo-Daro being Dravidian culture, the horn god of the seals and all this other stuff, and she just smashed it. There are these little oval sort of objects around which were supposed to be Shiva lingams. They weren't Shiva lingams. She had. The older the lingams are, the more anatomically correct they are. We had big pictures. Look at these very old lingams. So these are the modern egg-shaped ones are really, really, you know, a product of probably of Victorian English or Muslim influences. So anyway, it just shot it down, and the whole Aryan invasion thing that went along with it, and everybody in the room was going yep, 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 and I thought, you know, how many more years will be before this gets into the textbooks? And so the Aryan invasion has been gradually changed over the years from the Aryan invasion to the Aryan migration. It was a peaceful migration that took hundreds of years. And then when I was at Berkeley, as a matter, in fact, J.F. Stahl was there. There was a panel discussion at Berkeley, a bunch of young scholars, about six or eight of them, who had been having this big discussion by internet, and then at some other convention, regional convention, they had discussed it, and now it was at Berkeley. The lecture hall was filled. I mean, it was packed. It was like the attraction. Again, this is the American Academy of Religion. And people were getting up one after another in different areas, showing there was no evidence that the Aryans came from anywhere into India. And there was no linguistic evidence, there was no archaeological evidence, there was no textual evidence, there was no... They just shot it down one after another. Bang, 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 bang. And at the end of the... And everybody is going, yep, yep, that's right. No, and basically, what's the position? We don't know what happened. Now, the only guy who objected was J.F. Stahl. He was in the audience. And he, by now he's quite elderly and he's retired. And he said, it was right at the end, he said, because there was a big long discussion, I want to go back to the discussion, because the issue came up, I'll do this now, the issue came up, if there's no evidence, why did this theory get promulgated and why was it held for so long? I mean, that became like an amazing fact.
I mean, one reason is very simple, is because it was done during the British.
Exactly, yeah.
It was self-serving. And even yeah,
exactly.
Language was allowed to say that A, everybody in India that existed, invaded India, B, and that the British come from the quote-unquote source.
That the Indians are actually Europeans.
Indigenous.
Yeah, because, I mean, here they were at that time in the 19th century, the people still worship Greece and Rome as the height of European civilization. These were obviously an older culture from which these Greece and Rome descended. They were astounded by the discovery of Sanskrit grammar, the whole science of linguistics, because of Panini. They were just amazed, you know, they realized, and the Upanishads were coming and they were like, the level of culture was amazing, and yet we're the Europeans and who are these, you know, these little brown guys wandering around here in these big diapers and so the answer was, well, the Aryans were basically from the Caucasus, they were Caucasian, they were Europeans that came in. That was the answer. There was just, and that was done. I tell you, anything that was established in the 19th century in any field, look at it critically.
No, true. This is probably true. One of the three controversies 10 years ago, or even last 5 years ago, was by this person called Martin Bernard, who frequently argues that the way archaeology has been established genes and some of the classical scholars is influenced by 19th century racist theories.
Mm-hmm.
And the human cry was amazing. It was really amazing. Now half of the things he said is right, half of the things he said, you know, is true, you know. But half of the things he said right and challenged were eventually absorbed and accepted, but he was taken as wrong. So like today Martin Bernard, like, in classical studies is considered as a nitwit.
Mm-hmm.
But half of the things he argued are totally accepted for it. Just in the span of less than 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And it's just bizarre because some of the foundations of these fields are, even if they sound very old, are late middle 19th century.
Yeah, I want somebody to look at Indo-European philology again.
Yeah, I mean, I would actually argue with my professor.
That's like considered to be like, so, and I bet you if you started to look at it critically.
I mean, that's what one of his theses was, that so-called Indo-European philology, where the connections between Sanskrit and are taken to be as if there is a mother language.
Yeah, right.
He argued, no, that if you look at ancient Chinese, the relative comparison between ancient Chinese and ancient Greece compares significantly similar to the comparison between ancient Greece and ancient Sanskrit. So, like, if there is a certain notion of a tree of language, and Chinese is thrown out of it, creates this myth of Caucasian origin, unknown Caucasian origin of Greece and Chinese. And so then Chinese have to be included in it, and you cannot do that. You cannot interpret into Chinese.
Interesting.
So definitely they are. And even today, you know, they don't. But like the classic department, you still study Sanskrit, but try studying Chinese in the classic department.
Yeah, right. I mean, I think people pretty understand that most knowledge now is theory driven. You know, it's got a theory in the background, and the theory is like, you know, shows some things and hides other things, illuminates some things and other things, and you know. Oh, there was another big revolution in North American archaeology with the dates of when people first showed up there, because it was the reigning doctrine that this Clovis culture, Clovis, New Mexico, a certain kind of spear, that this was the oldest thing. And there was much older people, and the people who were holding that, they lost their jobs, they got thrown out of the departments, you know. The whole thing like that was like a real persecution.
How do you die out? Didn't you know, you know, that's the way departments work. You teach a theory which you may be wrong for 20 years, and then you become part of the department, and eventually you die out.
Yeah, that's how things change, right.
That's the best way departments work. And the same thing with textbooks.
But one guy who was a big adherent to the Clovis culture was primary, after he began to have doubts about it, the same place that he was digging for Clovis culture, he went down deeper and found older stuff. He said he never thought of digging any deeper because he already knew there was nothing there. So, you know, beware of what you know.
That's what I like about deconstructive
search. Yeah, that's true.
It's a basic assumption which cannot be examined in the system itself.
It's true. That's right. System, well, that's right. Yeah, and as soon as you want to do that, they'll say, "Go to another department." You know, you're not in this department anymore. You're not. You don't belong to our group anymore.
Or you break down the whole system. Or you try to break down the whole, collapse the whole foundation.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's true. This is a point of knowledge. So I have a more open mind. I cannot explain how it is. I accept the Vedas is true and what this, but I cannot always explain how it's true, or how it. You fit it together with our experience. I assume a good deal of what we experience is valid, but how you fit it together, it's not just a problem between the Vedas and modern thinking. Like, for example, in the Bhagavatam, there's a cosmology which does not have very much resemblance to the universe as we know it. But there's another cosmology which is in the Jyotir Shastra, which describes pretty much the observable universe as we know it. The planets are balls floating in space. There's a fairly accurate and very old times before the Greeks of the diameter of the Earth. The measurement was there. But it doesn't fit together with the cosmology in the Bhagavatam, which displays the Earth. There's this Bhumandala which stretches out in space, apparently seems to somehow coincide with the plane of the ecliptic, with concentric rings, oceans, and the middle ring is Jambudweep, and there's a Mount Meru in the middle. Which like a spindle which goes all the way up, which is narrow at the base and wider at the top. This whole cosmology.
I'm philosophically talking, this notion that you already mentioned between philosophers and something which stands outside the reality of absolute truth and relativity. At some point this needs to be brought up
with
you.
That what?
You said something which would, you know, the duality of an absolute versus relative. Mm-hmm. You know, even if you accept one, by default you're accepting the other two. Mm-hmm. And something which stands outside and allows you to merge this duality. That kind of theory of thinking is
well. Yeah, well, that's the real absolute then. Mm-hmm. The absolute that includes and doesn't exclude the relative, right? That's the quotation of the Isha Upanishad. You have to know vidya and avidya side by side. So exactly how to do that of a case in all times, I cannot say. But as far as I know, that if I want to practice Krishna consciousness, And if I want to make advancement in Krishna consciousness, I'm not in any position to say to Prabhupada, well, this I accept and this I don't accept. Then that's going to really hamper my practice of devotional service. So
that is the point. I mean, this is one big argument we have in our debate. If you actually do that, you might as well write the Bhagavad Gita yourself.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah, well, then you've become the authority, but you're the one with the problem. How can I become the authority? I'm not in a position to, so I accept it. But all my whole career, there's things I've put into brackets. I've put into brackets. One of them was the theory of evolution. You know, I mean, it really flipped me out when I became a devotee. I kind of understood our philosophy, but I never really concretely meant that I didn't believe in the theory of evolution. And which is a cornerstone, of course, of biology. And everything is explained in evolution. Anything new fact is discovered, it's immediately fit into the prevailing theology of why it fits with the theory. But then I met with Sariputta. Well, then Prabhupada said, I asked Prabhupada if he had any suggestions of what I could do for a doctoral dissertation in the religion department, and he said that I could disprove Darwin. And I was just, he suggested it, he didn't say I had to do it. And I was just horrified. Because anybody I knew who's against Darwin, you know, with these Christian Jesus, you know, one big stupid me and Jesus saves sign. I didn't buy the whole cultural thing that went along with it. But anyway, Prabhupada said it was wrong, so I said, oh, I have no idea how it's wrong. I have no idea. And then I met Sariputta, who just finished his doctoral dissertation in mathematics. And being a mathematician, you know, he had no particular stake in the theory of evolution. and he had all these arguments, and he said that he understood that the theory of evolution was incorrect before he became a devotee. Because his area was information theory. And he was showing me these arguments based on information theory that it wouldn't work. And he's done other things in mathematical biology that shows that it doesn't work. And sure enough, there are people around who are mathematical biologists who have real problems with it. Now, of course, there's truth to the theory. We know that natural selection and adaptation take place. That's something everyone sees. But this turns out to be, you know, the key to how one species comes from another and how, like, species originate from molecules and everything. It's, again, you take one fact that you know is true, and you can see adaptation take place, but you want to make this mechanism now account for everything. And anyway, there's pretty good arguments, not even on a rational basis, that at least is the theory for the origin of life and all the different species, it's inadequate. But people have this way of not dealing with it. When I read the account, this account of cosmologists meeting in Washington, D.C., where someone presented an argument, again using statistical mathematics, that the universe, if the initial conditions of the universe were totally random, there's no way any amount of order could have arisen by chance in the given amount of time. And so he proposed that the initial conditions were not at random. There was at the very beginning some order. This was controversial because this was called the stacked deck theory as opposed to the shuffled deck theory. Because it was controversial because when you say that there's an original some order in the initial conditions, you want to know how it got there. Because apparently complete randomness requires no explanation, but order we want to have. And it says that somebody even mentioned God. There, I guess the traditional stacker of decks, huh? Somebody mentioned God. And then the account I read said, but most scientists prefer not to take that cop-out route. End of the argument. What does it mean to say that? What makes it a cop-out route? Well, because the rules of the game are that we don't invoke God. If you want to talk about God, go to the theology department or religion department or philosophy department even, but don't stay
in the philosophy department.
But the physicists would say the philosophy department. They think they're all mushy people anyway. But really, I mean, it means that there's a game you play, and the game has rules, and one of the rules is you don't bring in God. It's a cop out. It solves your problem. You got to do it. With the trick is to do it without God. It's just a ground rule. It's like if you see some people playing tennis, and you could say to them, you know, you'd have a lot easier time getting that ball in the other court if you get rid of the net. They say, no, that's a game. We have to have the net, you know. I mean, who sets the ground rules? And who says, I mean, this is a condition for investigation of truth, you know, that a priori, it's not even a priori, it's a rule of the game. It sets the boundaries of your discourse. Everybody knows in academics, look, the most powerful argument in any discussion is, we don't do that. We don't do that in this department. We don't do that anymore. Right? It's the most powerful argument. It's not done.
Within the veil, parampara.
Huh?
Within the veil.
Yeah.
In its own veil, it's parampara. Every department has its own.
They really do. And I don't mind, but it's just unacknowledged, you know.
Part of the sense of, you know, it's the proper in the sense, it's like the boundaries at which you need to evoke God has been extended, you know. You had a word God earlier to extend simpler phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
Now we may need to evoke God to extend the first 15 seconds of the cosmos.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So those boundaries have been extended. So it's like this, maybe we can extend the bond even further.
Further, sure.
The other problem is we haven't really come up with a convincing argument for the skeptics to actually believe in God. Even after 2000 years of Christian attempt at that.
Hmm.
You know? So it's like for scientists to actually acknowledge that argument within their own rules,
mm-hmm.
even today.
Well, you know, but again, you know, science itself, in some ways, the whole scientific enterprise, let's, at least historically, see how much we can figure out without God, you know.
Or even if we are, I mean, Newton's theory, at some point, we're trying to keep turning
the philosophy. Yeah, his biggest arguments are theological, right? But we don't hear about that, do we? He wrote tons of stuff. Most of his writings were.
Even though the theory of gravitation was basically in a way to suggest that about God. You know?
Yeah.
So it was also turned around in terms of to explain God better.
Yeah, right.
And not.
To
the domain of our own.
So. Yeah.
I mean, I think the other way one could talk about is suspension of phenomena which one does not achieve in contemporary knowledge or contemporary experience. You know, like one reads that in philosophy department or other department, you read about Aristotle.
About what?
Aristotle or Plato.
Yeah.
So mm-hmm. Now Plato's theories of like logic. Aristotle is being logical. Shown to be, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But to understand Aristotle better, you have to actually suspend that kind of problem and work with what is.
Sure. I, you know, the thing is, if you sit and you read Aristotle, it's so nice. It's like putting on a pair of glasses. You can suddenly see the universe through Aristotle's eyes, you know. It certainly doesn't count for a lot of things, but it actually is quite, it makes sense, and it does some things really, really nicely that nothing else kind of does it so well.
And, you know, eventually you do develop a certain sense of insight into what you can say, and those insights have still are completely valuable and
yeah, right.
That's why I think I actually sometimes want to argue that it's pertaining to suspension of the, you know, the framework and letting the text project that framework to it.
I mean, ultimately, to me, you know, I guess at least from, I believe that the theories are pragmatic, that they're good for something, and ultimately, you know, what a purely materialistic view of the world does is it's so destructive of human life. And human values, and since, you know, it does some good things, but this is the downside. And if we have another side to ourselves that's not material, that's spiritual, here's this account of the world that the Bhagavad Gita gives. There's the absolute truth, there's the material energy, there's the spiritual energy. These three things compromise knowledge. What's matter, what's spirit, what's the control of both? It's a kind of map of reality. But you use that map, you can start and look at yourself that way. This is consciousness, this is the soul, this is the mind, this is the subtle body, this is the not-self. You see it that way. Then you can see what's the route to liberation, how you can get out. And then you apply it. Okay, this is what I have to do. And you see what happens. And it works. That's the case. It works. And it keeps on working. It just it goes so far, you know. Everything that's been promised step by step is being delivered. I have no reason to stop.
I mean, sometimes you
can. You know, whether they went to Mars or not, I really, you know.
I don't care. Oh, yeah, so long as you don't bring some of those viruses. Some of the Hollywood movies. You know? I went to the moon, big deal. But because the existential conditions of our life are one absolute. You know, they were absolute 2,000 years in some way, it's structured here, there,
mm-hmm.
you know, life, birth, death, and some sense of acknowledgement of...
Yeah, it doesn't change, does it? So, no. Right.
So, and that's why in the way one could say that you don't even have to argue about absolute or relative, so that would be that complete authority, because it has dealt with this existential condition for long.
You know, when you go in the biology department, you got to play the game by their rules. You got to think your way into that. You be in that mindset, and you have to deal with it. But I don't think you have to take it as ultimately the whole truth about everything.
And I don't.
Okay, that's good. Congratulations. But how to reconcile it? That's another. You know that.
And I don't. And I don't reconcile it.
Mm-hmm.
I have a hard time saying, okay, in this real world as described by the Vedas, it's real. And the thing that we're looking at is, I don't know what, but I have a hard time with that as well.
Well, the thing is that if one actually follows the whole process that's given, the sadhana of Krishna consciousness, then you'll start to see things in a different way.
I mean, even the whole idea is probably not so important.
What whole idea?
Well, not idea, the facts that are listed in the scripture, whether they're real or not. It's more...
No, if they're, don't worry about it. The real thing is develop love of God.
Exactly. So... In one sense, it doesn't matter.
No, that's true. It's not relevant. But on the other hand, well, yeah, it's not.
It's sort of an intellectual exercise. I always get myself at all confused.
Yeah, you shouldn't let that be an obstacle.
No, it's not. I mean, I see that there are many truths that are actually visible to me.
Mm-hmm.
Already it's validated, but
yeah, okay.
It's seeing the same thing as a body.
But yeah, to me, you just got to understand something. You got to understand this universe is really, really big. It's been going on a long time. With our own senses in any kind of systematic way, we only have a record of about 200 years of investigation. So many things in the past we were sure were right turned out to be wrong. And we have this habit of saying, we used to think, but now we know. And what we should say is, we used to know, but now we think. Things are going to change. Things can change. If you really wanted to be a really good researcher, my suggestion is you should really study the Vedas and become Krishna conscious, and then let Krishna guide your intelligence, and you'll make many new discoveries. There's a whole lot more to be known. I really think that what we know now is about 1/1000th of 1% of what there is to be known, and most of it's wrong. It's very, very, we think we got it almost all figured out. I think people are going to discover that it's much, much bigger and much, much more complex than we know now. Just if you take the idea in the Bhagavad Gita, for example, that we have this gross body, earth, water, fire, air, ether, solids, liquids, gases, radiant energy, space. And then it says, there's manas, buddhi, ahankara. This is the material energy. The things we call mind, intelligence, false egos. Now right now biology can't deal with it. But let's say it's real. Let's say it's, well, we'll call them subtle energies. Subtle means right now we don't know how to measure them or how to detect them. But let's say they're there. That means that everything we know about a living body is partial, because there are things, there are interactions. Just the way we know our minds subjectively, of course I know I have feelings. And I know that if I drink alcohol, my mind becomes confused. If I become angry, my blood pressure goes up. We know this interaction between the gross and the subtle. We know this going on. So there's all kind of, that means that if the subtle body is a real material thing, only something that right now is beyond our powers to detect and relate, that means all kinds of things are going on within a living body that we're missing. We're missing causes, missing relationships. And if you think that the only thing that's there are the gross elements, you'll never have the idea of even looking for something else. But if you have a theory that says there's a subtle body, subtle means very, very hard to detect. But if you have that theory, you're thinking, well, it's there, it's working, it's acting. Maybe there's some instrumentation, or there's some theoretical concision. You know, some way, just like in physics, you know, how they got such subtle things now. And how do they know they're there? You know, as by the most roundabout way of getting at it. But if you don't have an inkling that something's there, you'll never even think to look for it. So actually, Krishna consciousness could help your career. And that's not just a problem to deal with. Yeah. Because and all the other thing is that there's our own brain. And there's the other brain, that's the super soul, who's the vast, active, living intelligence that's running the universe. And according to the Bhagavad Gita, we get direction from the super soul. And that's what's happening when somebody wakes up in the morning after a dream of two snakes and thinks of the double helix. How do they, you know, this is super soul. Huh?
I think my connection with the mother will take it
over. Well, one thing about Krishna consciousness is to hook up to the like real intelligence. Because we know when we think that there's sometimes we at least have the intuition that there's somebody inside of me that's kind of smarter than I am. And so once in a while we get flashes of it. We call it inspiration. We don't know where it comes from, but it's a lot smarter and a lot more together than I am. We would ascribe that to Super Soul. But anyway, it begins by chanting. Anything else, huh?
You look at the dilemma in science first. Last semester, I took a course in on Bhagavad Gita, and we read the four different versions of the Gita, the Ramana version, the Prabhupada, Vedic Gita, and the Shankaracharya version.
Which is the third one?
Devi Gita.
It's
presented as a mixture of Shankara and Tantric philosophy.
Okay.
It's also.
Where'd you have this course?
Huh?
Where was this course?
At Lesser Bryant.
Huh? Oh yeah. Ma Muni is there. Yeah, right. Uh huh. So go ahead.
And I don't know why, but like I'm also in the science field, but I haven't really faced the big dilemma between science and religion, even though I know it exists.
Mm-hmm.
In personal life, I haven't realized it. But just by like reading these four different philosophers, I'm just confused that okay, there's four different types of Gita. Why don't we start at the basic step, and why is there no common understanding between these four before you go out and try to mix it with the rest of the world? there's one of the biggest things, like all three of them go against Shankara's viewpoint on the Super Soul, like you were saying.
Mm-hmm.
It says in chapter 15 about Dwadimokur, Sarlokeshara, Chakravarti, and then the next one is Uttamahapurusha, Sanya, Paramatma, Dhyayata. Those two stanzas, chapter 15, 16, 15, 17, like say that there's three different types of souls, the fallible, the infallible, and the super soul.
Mm-hmm.
But Shankara doesn't mention any. Shankara just says that there's everything is like Brahma.
Yeah, right.
And then you see Ramanujan, who breaks it up by saying that there's an Atman and there's a cosmic energy that is represented as the soul.
Mm-hmm.
Or Jiva. Atman and Jiva, I think.
I don't know about that. That doesn't sound right.
Prakriti
means the material energy.
Yeah, Prakriti and Atman are that's what
he. That's okay. Well, yeah, that's sure.
And then you have.
But he doesn't talk about Paramatma.
Huh?
He
didn't
talk about Paramatma. Well, in that chapter, there's three things: Prakriti, Kshetra, Kshetrajna, and the two Kshetrajnas too. There's the Atma and the Paramatma.
Yeah.
Prakriti, Atma, and Paramatma. Right?
Yeah. And like, what I got as a Prabhupada was that there's an impersonal being and there's a personal being, and he explained that there's three different types of but there's a the fallible, the infallible, and the Paramatma.
Mm-hmm.
Like they both explain it different. Like that's what I'm trying to get to. Is there any understanding of those that is?
I'm sorry, I haven't looked at the other commentators, so I couldn't really on these particular verses give you an understanding.
I mean that's just an example of mm-hmm. one point of conflict between the four.
Well, sometimes it's not a conflict. You have to get into it. I mean, probably between. I don't know what to do about Shankaracharya because I think that he's doing a kind of deliberate snow job. You know, and it's been at least even most scholars agree that this is the case with Shankara. You know, it used to be every Bhagavad Gita that you would get by a scholar would kind of reflect a Shankarite point of view. But I was just teaching a class. I was reading Barbara Stola Miller's translation of the Gita, and there's this verse, Brahmano hi pratishtaham, at the end of the chapter on the three modes of material nature. Krishna says, Brahmano hi pratishtaham. I thought this was a clincher, you know. I am the pratishta, the foundation, the basis, the support of Brahman. I really thought it was but there it is. It's really clear. And then I look at Shankaracharya, and he says that in this verse, Brahman means the total material energy. Which in the beginning of that chapter, that's the word use of the word Brahman. Krishna said he uses it that way in the beginning of that chapter. However, in the immediate verse preceding that verse, Mamchayo Vyabhicharena Bhakti Yogena Sevate Sagunan Samiti Chaitan Bambuyaya Kalpate. One performs devotional service in a steady way without any deviation, he transcends the modes of material nature and comes to the platform of Brahman. So Brahman is used there, not as the next adjoining verse. And then Brahmano hi pratishtaham, and then I am the basis of this Brahman. You know, I mean, so Shankara, really does a job to get around that one. And but I saw that in Brahma Stola Miller's translation, she has a footnote, you know, which accepts that Krishna is in fact saying, I am the basis, the foundation, or the support of Brahman, which he didn't used to see because everybody was so just followed Shankaracharya. They felt he was the authority. So with Shankara, it's I really did come to the conclusion, I think, not just based on blind faith in Srila Prabhupada, that Shankaracharya is doing a kind of a job on this thing to force his conclusion. The earliest commentator?
No.
Oh, that's probably not true. He may be the earliest surviving one.
Yes, earliest surviving.
Yeah.
In his introduction, he even says there's someone.
Yeah, yeah. You see, and unfortunately, you know what happened? Shankaracharya comes right after the Buddhists. He's attributed with driving the Buddhists out. And when the Buddhists took ascendancy, you got to understand what happened. Huge numbers of texts were destroyed. Paramparas fell apart. The whole traditional lineages were broken. And we really don't know very well what was going on before Buddha. And the case that we make is that what you see in Ramanuja and others is actually a restoration of what was actually the original Vedic teachings before Buddha. And that Shankaracharya was a kind of a compromise with Buddhism for tactical purposes for Vedic restoration. Now, you're going to get arguments all over the place about that, but you can make the case. There's certainly enough evidence around for that. But he's kind of the odd man out as far as Gita commentaries. Almost everyone agrees now that the Gita is a theistic document, and the Vaishnavas rightly claim it, and that Shankaracharya wants to use it because of its prestige and everything like that, but he really has to do some violence to the text to make it come out the way he wants to, such as passing over certain things in silence and taking a more remote meaning of a word to make a text fit and things like that. I don't feel necessary to say that every commentator has got to be reconciled. And the other thing is, that we're not so bothered if you get these texts, which are very, very rich, and different people get different things out of them. That's another way, you know, of seeing the same text, if they're both acknowledged authorities, and they're both then you have to say that somehow or other, you know, both of them are two different ways of looking at the same text. That's all.
I asked that question only because I was studying the Gita before on my own, and I.
Now you're worse off that you took this course.
Yeah,
huh?
I was like all these different texts with some different versions, and I was like, it ended up leaving, like when I left that class, I left with the dilemma, like a personal conflict.
Uh-huh.
Like, how can you say this is right when you're saying something else is wrong? And if you're saying that's wrong, then how do you not know that this is wrong? And that has to do with what you were talking about earlier, about the authoritative and...
Yeah, well, as Prabhupada says, ultimately, at least as far as Prabhupada goes, we're accepting, in a way, when it comes to adjudicating the various statements of the Vedas, we accept Chaitanya Mahaprabhu as the authority.
And I like that quote, because like he was talking about, like, it doesn't really matter, like, what you are following, as long as you're on the, like, on a path that's towards, that you believe is towards the correct goal, like, in this case, liberation.
Love of God, how about that
love
one?
Love of God.
Well, you may believe it, but still, you should ascertain that it's the correct path. They have to get in the right position to know. And that can be done. Anyway, it's a whole long discussion that we've gone late now. Thank you. Thank you. It's not just arbitrary. You have to know how to receive guidance from Krishna. You have to know.